from WNYC in New York. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. We're gathered here today to celebrate a time-honored tradition. Well, maybe not celebrate. And maybe not honored. But certainly timely, the political lie.
You know, the police say that didn't happen, and all those rumors have been on the internet for some time. So did you misspeak yesterday?
It did happen. I saw it.
You saw that with your own eyes?
ABC's George Stephanopoulos last December questioning Donald Trump on one of his most dubious claims.
George, it did happen. There were people that were cheering in the other side of New Jersey where you have large Arab populations. They were cheering as the World Trade Center came down.
The political lie. Not new, but somehow more prominent during this election season than ever before. Perhaps because one of the chief falsifiers is so unabashedly unrepentant, much to the frustration of those with the job of challenging him. NBC's Chuck Todd.
Mr. Trump, if I said, well, people have said Mr. Trump's not worth $10 billion, you would say that was crazy. You're running for president of the United States. Your words matter. Truthfulness matters. Fact-based stuff matters.
Make it easy, Chuck. Just play cool.
Back in December, when we first aired this show, the nation was embarking on the primary election season that would end in Donald Trump being named the presumptive Republican nominee. Back then, the pundits didn't think he stood much of a chance, in part because of the abundance of his lies. But he triumphed, and the lies have continued. Just this week, Trump scored a pants on fire from PolitiFact when he said,
"It's about Hillary in terms of religion. Now, she's been in the public eye for years and years, and yet there's nothing out there."
Actually, PolitiFact listed many, many citations of Clinton speaking of her Methodist faith on the trail and throughout her career. But Trump was only the most flamboyant of this year's crop of fabricators. So as we head into the next phase of this lengthy election season, we offer a reprise of our show all about lies. We begin with a taxonomy of the political lie.
Let's start with lies of omission, withholding key facts or context that renders the claim untrue.
If you like your health care plan, you can keep your health care plan.
The president made a promise he knew would be impossible to keep. Obamacare did allow for the continuation of current health plans, but only if they complied with strict rules, and many couldn't. And then there are lies of distortion.
We have 93 million people out of work. They look for jobs, they give up, and all of a sudden, statistically, they're considered employed.
Can it be? 93 million people don't work? Yep, but that includes nearly 38 million people of retirement age, 10 million stay-at-home moms, roughly 6 million students, 9 million on disability. In other words, a lie. And there are lies of exaggeration.
In the United States, we spend twice as much per capita on healthcare as any other nation on earth.
We do spend more per capita, but not twice as much. Then there are those adorable lies of personal biography.
I was offered a full scholarship to West Point, got to meet General Westmoreland, go to Congressional Medal of Honor dinners.
That's so wrong, it's hilarious. But everybody does it. There are lies of invention. You know, when candidates appear to go into a fugue state.
Welders make more money than philosophers.
And of course, the bald-faced lie. Very popular this season.
This agreement trusts the Iranians to inspect themselves.
But I also understand that Obamacare isn't helping anyone.
Every time we raise the minimum wage, the number of jobless people increases.
The federal government right now does not deport criminals.
I do not believe that human activity is causing these dramatic changes to our climate.
And every season.
I remember landing under sniper fire.
I did not have sexual relations with that woman.
And though I'm sure you could slice and dice these categories ever finer, I'll end with the lie that has its basis in the feeling that it must be true, even when all the evidence shrieks otherwise, that's clung to even as it molders in its grave. Like the lie about weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, or this immortal formulation from Ronald Reagan.
A few months ago, I told the American people I did not trade arms for hostages. My heart and my best intentions still tell me that's true, but the facts and the evidence tell me it is not.
There are the lies that spill from the mouths of politicians and the lies we tell ourselves and each other every day. Maria Hartwig, a social psychologist at John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York, who focuses on lying, says there's a notable challenge in trying to calculate how often people lie because, well, you know.
Given the moral status of lying, if you ask people the question, they might lie in response. Nevertheless, the studies that we have on lying shows that everybody lies and people tend to lie at least a couple of times a day.
Now, there are lies and there are lies. There is, I never had sex with that woman, Miss Lewinsky. And then there is, oh, what a beautiful baby.
I suspect that many lies that are told on the fly in social life, we don't even stop to register that they're lies. And the lie told to a friend in that instance is in all likelihood told to spare them from any negative feelings. We tell them because we care about them.
Now, there's yet another category that I think is not unique to politicians, but it's very much in their province, and that is saying things not so much to deceive as to just seduce an audience. There's a term of art for this.
There is.
And that is?
It's bullshit. This is a term from the philosopher Harry Frankfurt. He pointed out that when telling a lie, you know what the truth is and you're deliberately trying to cover it up. In contrast, when people produce bullshit speech, they have little or no interest in what the actual facts are. The motivation lies elsewhere. It's because you want to win. Whether this is a correct representation of reality or not is secondary.
And we've had a very trenchant example of that recently. It's entirely possible that Donald Trump wasn't lying when he said this.
I watched when the World Trade Center came tumbling down. And I watched in Jersey City, New Jersey, where thousands and thousands of people were cheering as that building was coming down. Thousands of people were cheering.
There were no contemporaneous police reports or complaints from citizens. The journalism did not bear this description out in any way, shape, or form. And yet, that's his story, and he's sticking with it, not necessarily because he's lying, simply misremembering, which I guess is what makes eyewitnesses, some of whose testimony can send someone else to the death chamber, not necessarily reliable.
Right. So whenever you face a statement that clearly deviates from the facts that you have to make one of three judgments, and they're very difficult to make, if not impossible. One is that the person is simply misremembering. The second is that the person is lying, that they know that this didn't happen. And the third is that they simply don't care. And that would put them in the Frankfurt's bullshit category.
We've established that everyone's a liar, that nobody wants to be branded a liar, that people yet confess to being a liar, at least when it comes to social lies. And yet another that we demand in politicians a level of truthfulness that we don't exhibit in our own lives. And then still again, that we have a tendency to believe what they say, even though we also believe that all politicians lie.
You're right that there are many paradoxes in how we think about lies. If I'm telling a lie to you, I can justify it because of reasons X, Y, Z, and it doesn't necessarily in my own self-image make me a bad person. But if you're lying to me, or I imagine that you are, it reflects negatively on your character. There is a classic study conducted in the 1960s where people were asked to evaluate a whole bunch of different adjectives that describe ways in which you can be abrasive, forthcoming, 555 different labels that you can place onto people. The worst thing, it seems, that you can be is a liar. Yet the people who filled out that questionnaire, in all likelihood, told at least one lie during that day. Now, politicians, of course, face a very difficult task because circumstances that are involved in being a politician invite dishonest speech, more so than ordinary life. They have to produce a lot of speech. which increases the probability that you will tell a lie. And there's such a strong motivation to say things that you think that people want to hear. My suspicion is that it's not really the case that a certain type of people is attracted to this role of a politician where you get to fib and manipulate endlessly. I think it's
that they, as a practical matter, have to fib because there is a penalty often for being caught in a truth.
Yes. They might have come to the conclusion that it would be more damaging to actually be honest.
Which is the final paradox, is it not, that while we claim to demand and expect truth from our candidates, we actually turn out not to like candor any more than we like that brutally honest person in our family or our workplace who just gives you their unvarnished thoughts, come what may.
I think people have a very conflicted relationship with getting the truth. I think they want the truth if it fits with what they want to hear.
What would Jack Nicholson say?
Well, that they can't handle it. And I think that's probably right. In many instances, they wouldn't necessarily want to live in a world where honesty was universal.
Maria, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Maria Hartwig is a professor of psychology at John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York, where her specialty is lying.
You want answers!
I want the truth!
You can't handle the truth!
Coming up, how the media have responded to some of history's most toxic lies. Call it fact news.
This is On the Media.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Political lies have a rich history. Take, for instance, the sinking of the USS Maine off the coast of Havana in 1898. 2 days after the sinking, the New York Journal declared that the Maine had been brought down by a Spanish torpedo, helping to launch the Spanish-American War. But there was no Spanish torpedo, just a U.S. publisher, William Randolph Hearst, who wanted a war and plenty of politicians who felt the same way. Or we could look at President Johnson and the 1964 Gulf of Tonkin incident, when the president claimed the U.S. military had been attacked twice by the North Vietnamese. The media repeated the claim, and Congress authorized Johnson to use military force in Vietnam. But Johnson later admitted to an aide that there probably had been no second attack, and for all he knew, the U.S. sailors may have just been shooting at flying fish. The war lasted another 10 years. Rick Perlstein is a writer for The Washington Spectator. He says that though the lies never cease, the kind of lies politicians tell and get away with has shifted over the last half century, beginning in the waning years of the Vietnam War with a moment of optimism.
There was this brief period in the 1970s in which truth became fashionable in American politics. You know, you had Senate hearings on the deceptions of the CIA. You had, of course, the Watergate hearings. You had a strong sense that the job of the media was to call powerful institutions to account. And one of the things that ended it was Ronald Reagan saying America was still a city on the hill, that we're God's chosen nation, and that all these Debbie Downers in the media didn't need to be listened to.
They say that the United States has had its day in the sun, that our nation has passed its zenith. My fellow citizens, I utterly reject that view.
That was inherited by a generation of conservatives who really believed that they were fighting for civilizational stakes. And a kind of ends justifies the means logic entered the Republican Party.
When you discuss the press and its relationship to the political lie, something happened somewhere in, let's just say, the 90s, when the press stopped calling out lies for what they were.
There was a shift when the conservative movement began taking over the Republican Party in the wake of Richard Nixon and Spiro Agnew.
Agnew famously used the press as a political tool and tried to describe them as a kind of sinister other.
The pampered prodigies of the radical liberals in the United States Senate have hatched their little chicks, and now they're coming home to roost. And that brings me to my target for tonight. The professional pessimist. In the United States today, we have more than our share of the nattering nabobs of negativism.
He was degrading their authority as referees. He said that they had a dog in the fight, you know, that they were these unelected aristocrats telling Americans what to think. They weren't these kind of gods 30,000 feet up on Mount Olympus proclaiming the truth, like, you know, someone like Walter Cronkite had done when he went to Vietnam and said, you know, we're losing this war.
To say that we are mired in stalemate seems the only realistic, if unsatisfactory, conclusion.
Once the press came to believe that their job was not to say this is a lie and this is the truth, but we have to be balanced between two ideological factions, that structurally advantaged the side that was more willing to lie.
And it really became a perfect closed system, because if the press did intervene, if it left its false equivalency, false objectivity,
Then they're biased,
and aha, everyone from Sarah Palin back to Spiro Agnew were right all along.
I've had the experience of calling out a lie by a Republican activist on, if you'll forgive me, a public radio show, and having the host, you know, jump down my throat for using the L word.
In fact, we happen to have a little bit of the tape with you and anti-tax firebrand Grover Norquist on the Diane Rehm Show.
Roll the tape.
No, I'm not for abolishing Social Security or Medicare or Medicaid. I'm for making them fully funded.
Right. Would you
like... Of course, Grover Norquist wants to get rid of Social Security and Medicare.
No, I don't.
It's his life's
don't tell
work.
Me my position, sir. I've written a book on the subject.
You said that you're a Leninist.
Rick,
no.
Hold on. Grover Norquist.
He's lying.
How would... please don't use such words on this program.
All right, Rick, that wasn't necessarily a triumph of civility, but why? Why was she offended? What was it about calling Grover Norquist a liar just based on the facts, something that she wasn't willing to listen to?
I got one thing wrong. Grover Norquist actually held up Stalin as his hero because he said Stalin controlled the personnel and Trotsky controlled the army. But the fact of the matter is I broke the rules of the game. The rules of the game say that both sides in a partisan dispute are supposed to be adjudicated, quote unquote, objectively. And if objective truth is traduced in the process, so be it.
With Trump, something new is going on. Nothing that comes out of his mouth is true, including the words and the.
Right. Dave Roberts of Vox did a wonderful piece that really kind of got to the bottom of this. You've always kind of been allowed to lie on policy, whether it was, you know, George Bush saying his tax cuts would go to the bottom half of the income distribution, or the stuff involving Iraq, or the stuff Mitt Romney was saying about what his economic policies would do, or Jeb Bush deciding that he could create a certain level of economic growth basically just by saying so. And the press doesn't like to adjudicate policy. But the other thing is quantitative. Dave Roberts points out that you're kind of allowed 9 lies, and as long as you kind of retract the 10th one once the media calls you out, everything's kosher. Donald Trump won't have any of that. We're in new territory now.
What does it mean for future elections and future populistic demagogues?
Well, of course, it's entirely frightening. But I think the silver lining, the redemptive movement in this can come on the side of the media. If they just basically stop worrying what politicians think about them, if they call out a lie and a politician squeals like a pig that they're biased, just act like a grown-up and keep on calling out the lies. Just do it.
Well, Rick, thank you so much.
Bob, it's a pleasure. Thanks.
Rick Perlstein is a writer for The Washington Spectator.
When we fact check, we don't think about how the politicians are going to react. Our goal is to inform voters and people who want to make a good decision based on accurate information.
Angie Drobnik-Holen is the editor of PolitiFact. The Pulitzer Prize-winning fact-checking site has a spectrum of 6 ratings to show the level of truth or mendacity for every political claim they investigate. As of this recording, the site has fact-checked 170 statements from Donald Trump, of which 4 received a rating of true. 69 of them have been ranked false, and 34 have been ranked as, quote, pants on fire, what you might call painfully wrong. There are times, however, that a claim doesn't fall on either end of that spectrum.
Our definition of the rating of half-true is the statement is partially accurate, but takes things out of context or leaves out important details. They've got something right here, but there's also a lot of things that are left out that would give you a different impression.
Which seems to define pretty much the lion's share of American political rhetoric. Here's one that you rated half true. It came from Trump talking about the deportation of immigrants at an earlier period in American history.
Let me just tell you that Dwight Eisenhower, good president, great president, people liked him, moved 1.5 million illegal immigrants out of this country, moved them just beyond the border, they came back. Moved them again beyond the border. They came back. Didn't like it. Moved them way south. They never came back.
In the 1950s, they thought that there were too many workers from Mexico in the United States. So they tried to forcibly deport some of them. So on that fact, Trump had something of a historical basis. He said they moved 1.5 million illegal immigrants out of the country. Well, the experts we talked to said that number was far too high. A more accurate number would be somewhere in the 250,000 range. He made it sound like they got a lot of people out of the country and it was easy. Well, it was controversial. It wasn't as many as he said. And it went along with new opportunities for legal immigration. So that's why we rated this one half true.
And then there is this other category that I find particularly nettling, and that is telling outrageous lies with facts. Let me give you an example. This is an ad against Rick Perry when he was running for re-election to the Texas governorship from the Democratic Governors Association.
This is the arm of an 11-year-old girl. Now, imagine a governor who wanted to take a needle, fill it with a controversial drug for sexually transmitted diseases, and inject it in every 11 and 12-year-old girl in Texas. That's what Governor Rick Perry wanted to do.
It was the HPV vaccine, the human papillomavirus, which causes cancer. So that fact was itself true, and yet what they're trying to suggest is just an obscene, obscene lie. Your organization rated that pants on fire over the issue of parental consent that was brought up in the ad, which they got completely wrong. But I wonder if the incendiary nature of the nominally true allegation would have it merited a pants on fire all by itself.
Sometimes political attacks are very inflammatory, but they're also accurate. One trend I've noticed over the years is that the political ad makers are scrutinizing their language much more carefully, so that sometimes they can claim literal truth. At PolitiFact, what we try to do is take those statements. If they're literally accurate, we put them in context. We try to not let the ad makers get the upper hand whenever they're presenting something as scary, that if you had more information, it would not seem scary. Those kind of statements don't get pristine ratings on our truthometer.
Do they deserve a category of their own, lying with the truth?
You know, I'm not sure. I mean, usually things are more straightforward than that. Those examples are rarer than you might think. Usually when something sounds wrong, it's because it is wrong.
Well, that's a good answer. I'm not sure it's right. Because I know even as we speak, there are opposition researchers poring over every legislative vote of every candidate, looking for some line in every piece of legislation that in a vacuum looks terrible and in context is perfectly ordinary, right? In fact, some of them are even planted in bills in order for subsequent campaign opposition researchers to have ammunition.
When we look at other candidates and they have these long congressional records, they are subject to attack. People thought that senators couldn't win the presidency because they took too many votes, ripe for distortion. Something that is really twisted will stand on its own for a bit until the journalists and the fact checkers come in and look at it and try to put it in its proper context. And then candidates who are savvy take the evidence that's vetted by independent journalists and they use it to fight back.
Let's just say that the political campaign is the digestive tract of the American body politic, and that all sorts of disgusting things go on in there for the sake of a healthy organism. I'm just curious, what part of the body is PolitiFact?
You know, I often think of PolitiFact as the vitamin for a balanced media diet. Like, you wouldn't want to read only fact-checking, but I don't think you would want to read political coverage without supplementing with a good bit of fact-checking information from credible and independent news organizations.
Angie Drobnik-Holin is the editor of PolitiFact. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me, Bob.
Coming up, how to fact-check candidates when they don't really care about the truth.
This is On the Media. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Throughout the winter and into the beginning of spring, pundits kept saying that once Trump's rhetorical excesses were exposed as mere Trumpery by the media, his support would drop off. Well,
Donald Trump decisively wins the Indiana primary and Senator Ted Cruz drops out of the race, making Trump now the presumptive Republican nominee. Here's
so we now know, yes, Donald Trump is a presumptive Republican nominee. Not even sure we have to use presumptive anymore.
Trump won the primaries decisively, as the pundits were proved decisively wrong about the public turning on Trump once his lies were exposed. Brendan Nyhan, assistant professor of government at Dartmouth College, has long researched the question of political lies, and it turns out demonstrable, undeniable truth rarely changes people's minds.
At least for the people who have political views that might lead them to want to hold a particular belief, it can be very hard. When my co-author Jason Reifler and I exposed experimental participants to a mock news article that had corrective information in it, it could sometimes provoke them into counter-arguing that claim. And that seemed to make them more likely to indicate that they believed in the misperception rather than less likely as we'd hope. And that's what so many fact-checkers and so many journalists have struggled to overcome.
Why is that? Why do people resist factual information?
It's hard for all of us to admit that we're wrong. It can be very uncomfortable, especially when what we're admitting we're wrong about implicates some aspect of our identity or worldview. Politics is, in some ways, the most important way that we express those values. And so it's especially hard for us to admit that we're wrong because it might say something about us or what we'd like to believe that we don't really want to hear or acknowledge.
I think William James once said that if they cannot deny the information away or attack the person bringing the information sufficiently to kill the information, then they will adjust their worldview only enough to include that information, leaving as much of it intact as they possibly can.
We've seen that with the fallout from the fact-checking of Donald Trump's claim to have seen thousands of people celebrating after September 11th in the United States. Trump supporters, many of them have fallen back on auxiliary claims that don't actually back up what Trump said. They say things like, well, there were people celebrating in the Middle East, or there might have been this story I heard about a dozen people here or there, as people, you know, struggle in any way they can to find some kernel of validity in this totally bogus claim that no one can support or back up.
One technique is to attack the messenger. And especially when the messenger are the media bringing evidence to the table. And it's probably because the media are such ripe targets, especially for conservatives.
That's right. In a Republican primary, if the choice is who do you believe, Donald Trump or the mainstream media, a lot of voters would say Donald Trump.
Does fact-checking ever have an impact on public opinion?
I think so. I mean, you know, Trump is kind of a perfect storm for fact-checking in the sense that he's totally indifferent to truth. But there's lots of other cases when fact-checkers can make a difference. When you get to less controversial politicians or issues that aren't as polarizing as September 11th or immigration, I think fact-checkers have a better opportunity to reach people who can be more open-minded. Trump is the exception. I've done research where we found that reminding legislators that they could be fact-checked seemed to make them more careful in the statements that they make.
Tell me about the wrong way to fact-check and the right way. I remember we've discussed that if you use the word not, it tends to drop out. So you can't refute the lie that the president was born in Africa by saying the president was not born in Africa, because after a few hours or a few days, people will forget the not and they'll just remember the assertion. So do not repeat the falsehood in your correction, right?
That's right. As human beings, we have a tough time with negations, but they are ways that the media could be more effective. One is to seek out people who are speaking against their political interests and draw on them as sources. The worst case scenario is the classic he said, she said, where it says a Republican says this and a Democrat says that, because that helps people sort themselves into competing tribes. I think one of the mistakes we make in assessing the effects of fact-checking is to focus so heavily on the presidential level, where people's partisan allegiances are so strong, it's going to be very difficult to change people's minds. They're following that race more like fans of a sports team than they are dispassionate, civic-minded voters, right? And that makes it really hard. The fact checks can kind of function like a sports page of accuracy, and then one side can say yay and the other side can say boo, but—
But you're not going to switch your team because of it.
That's right. That's right. Very rarely do we say, that ref is right, my team is cheating, and I am no longer a fan. But as you move down the ladder to members of Congress, governors, city councilmen, state legislators, those people get much less coverage. And so fact-checking, I think, can be more effective at those levels where people bring weaker predispositions to bear in thinking about whether they believe the fact-check or not.
Okay, Brendan, I get that. But do you find the more informed a person is, the less partisan they are in their beliefs?
No, precisely the opposite. The people who know the most about politics are the most polarized.
So the facts don't matter all that much.
They're part of the equation in how we make up their mind, but a lot less than we'd like to believe. You know, the social allegiances we have, the values we have, those often matter a lot more. We can't possibly understand everything that we're really expected to in politics, and so we use these cues and shortcuts.
How important do you think truth and most particularly lies are in political campaigns and in American life?
Politics isn't just about the facts. But if you deviate from the facts for long enough, reality does kick in. Americans got a sense that the war in Iraq wasn't going very well. And over time, that began to filter into their interpretations of national politics. And all the PR tactics in the world couldn't save the Bush administration from the political consequences of the choices they had made there. It's hard to maintain deception about the big issues over time. And we actually have a pretty good record, I think, of calling out people who are the most outrageous and dishonest. Trump stands as an anomaly historically in all sorts of ways, but one of them is he's breaching almost every modern campaign norm of what you can say as a politician. But I would expect that the patterns we've seen in the past will tend to persist. He's unlikely to get away with this forever.
Brendan, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Brendan Nyhan is an assistant professor in the Department of Government at Dartmouth College. As we noted, you are listening to a repeat of a show we first ran in December, a mythical time when Trump's nomination was unthinkable and, according to 538's Nate Silver, unsupported by the numbers. Silver told us that despite Trump's claim at the time that he was ahead in the polls, he was actually polling at about 8%, if you figure that he had 25% of the 25% of self-declared Republicans.
It's not that hard to get 6% or 8% of people to say much of anything in a poll. I mean, 6% of people, I think, told Gallup a few years ago that they thought the moon landings were staged.
In other words, Silver suggested that Trump's popularity was kind of a lie. He also noted that history shows that the American people are not likely to vote for a person like Trump. In March, after Trump defied the pundits and history to clinch the nomination, we spoke to Nate again and asked him what the hell happened.
There's not a lot of precedent for something like Donald Trump. I mean, this is something pretty amazing, and I don't know. I guess I don't feel that bad about having been initially skeptical.
Okay, I hear you, but I want to know about what you do feel bad about. I mean, the thing is you've got numbers, you're used to reading them a certain way. So is there somewhere where you went wrong or not? You read numbers for a living.
I do, and those numbers still suggest that it's very unusual for a candidate to win the nomination with as much opposition from within his own party as Donald Trump. I mean, there are a couple of issues here. One is extrapolating from history and realizing that we don't have that many examples. We have only one election every 4 years, and that maybe a lot of things that were true from the period from, say, 1980 through 2012, well, that sounds like a lot, but it's also still just one election every 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we said, well, Donald Trump is someone who's going to be vigorously opposed by Republican Party elites. So because it's so consequential, they'll find some way to stop him. Well, maybe not.
You mentioned historical precedent. How many elections are we really talking about to base these predictions on?
Well, since 1972, which is when you had the McGovern reforms and you started to have people actually vote in primaries, before it sort of literally was smoke-filled rooms, it's depending on how you count, somewhere on the order of 10, 12, 15. To say something hasn't happened in 12 tries is much different than when we also make sports predictions and we can say, well, this hasn't happened in 1,000 games. Then you're more existentially certain that something is really unlikely than you can be in the nomination process, or for that matter, the general election too, where there have been, I think, 16 or 17 now elections since World War II in the polling era. That's not a huge sample size either.
One thing that historians have noted is that there are political realignments every 40 years or so. This is when the parties kind of break apart and reassemble somehow. Describe a couple of political realignments, what happened in those elections, and whether you think we're in one of those right now.
You had the New Deal coalition in 1932 or so, where you had overwhelming majorities of voters were voting Democrat, both for FDR and for Congress. That was very sudden and very dramatic. The more recent transition was a little slower. It certainly started at about 1968 with Nixon's Southern Strategy. You could argue it didn't fully culminate until 1994, when Republicans won back a lot of seats in Congress in the South. I mean, people forget that it was a Democratic South, right? And the governor of Alabama was sure going to be a Democrat. He might have been George Wallace or someone who would not have very much in common with a Democrat in New York City, but certainly a capital D Democrat still. And that took some time to unravel. But, you know, I suppose I'm not sure whether the GOP is going through transition suddenly or if it'll take a couple cycles. But I am just saying that as someone who was skeptical, a lot of people were, but we were certainly skeptical about Donald Trump's ability to do what he's doing because the consequences would be so large for the GOP. Now that it's happening or on the verge of happening, we still think the consequences are really enormous. And it's a little bit like looking up and seeing that the sky is no longer blue, but orange.
Last week, you joked on Twitter that, quote, "with the exception of the 2016 election, will be a common phrase in PhD dissertations in 2044.
We're pretty good at placing events into context after we have some window of perspective. Somehow or another, by 2044, the 2016 election will fit into the narrative that we tell about how elections work. I do want people to understand how amazing it is as someone who covers elections. There are a lot of false alarms. There are a lot of elections where prognosticators cry wolf and say something new and different has happened when it wasn't. But this one, we almost feel like instead of wanting to calm everyone down and saying, no, you probably won't have a contested convention. No, you probably won't have a third-party candidate running. We have a different role this year. We want to be able to point out, like, this kind of breaks so many rules that we have to now consider what rules that we previously held to be true might also be wrong.
Nate, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Weren't sure about that, were you?
No, I totally am sure.
Nate Silver is the founder and editor of the data news site 538.com. He's also author of The Signal and the Noise, Why So Many Predictions Fail, But Some Don't. And 538 is our collaborator during this election season. We began this show about lies with Donald Trump. After all, as we've heard, he's broken the mold in that regard. But the people who support him, what does that say about them? According to Michael Lind, co-founder of the New America Foundation, what the rest of us think it says may be the most insidious lie of all, the one we tell ourselves about those other people. The lie or myth that explains to us how they could ever possibly disagree with what we know to be true.
For about half a century, if not longer, the right's fundamental narrative has been that liberals or progressives are snobbish, upper-class, unpatriotic traitors. The progressive narrative is that no person could possibly disagree with liberal positions like subsidizing, you know, wind and solar power unless they were emotionally disturbed and ignorant, or probably a combination of both. There's like this constant fear on the part of progressive intellectuals that at any moment their fellow citizens will turn out to be secret Nazis and round everybody up. You know, this undermines the progressive politicians for obvious reasons. You can't go, you know, and try to win over people who are voting for Republicans saying, vote for me, you crypto-fascist ignoramuses.
Where do they get this idea?
I would argue they got this from Marxist emigres from Weimar Germany who fled Hitler, Herbert Marcuse.
And sociologist Theodore Adorno.
Exactly. And Max Horkheimer. Marxism claimed that the working class should rally behind the Marxist intellectual vanguard, and in fact, that had not happened in the countries of Europe. And so they came up with a theory that the working class did not know its own interests. It suffered from so-called false consciousness. And so then they applied this in the 1950s in the United States, a much different society. There would be a lot of working class and middle class support, particularly for McCarthy, whom they tended to view as a kind of Hitler-type figure. Again, these are European immigrants, so they're interpreting American politics through the lens of their traumatic experience.
You also cite the historian Richard Hofstadter.
That's right. In addition to Marxist immigrants, more moderate centrist Northeastern liberal intellectuals, including Richard Hofstadter, Peter Viereck, Arthur M. Schlesinger Jr., tended to be upscale, very well-educated reformers with a very rationalistic approach to public policy. And they tended to interpret Americans who did not share their support for Adlai Stevenson and John F. Kennedy and so on as being irrational, ignorant people who were a danger to a civilized constitutional democracy. And I think the blend of these two strains of thought, the Marxist explanation of why the white working class does not rally behind left-wing socialist intellectuals, and this more centrist liberal explanation, trying to explain the phenomenon of McCarthyism and support for Barry Goldwater, and later for Ronald Reagan. I think these have essentially written the narrative that a lot of progressives unthinkingly rely on to this day. And their evidence for this is simply that people do not share liberal politics.
Let me get a clear idea of why Adorno and Hofstadter are wrong about the vulnerability of the masses to fascism.
Well, for one thing, the history simply doesn't work. And it particularly does not work for the McCarthy 1950s because that was the golden age of the American white working class and of capitalism. It was booming. Now, in the case of Nazi Germany in particular, the more recent scholarship shows that Hitler's support was not based on the alienated white working class, you know, mainly because of the Depression. He had solid support across every class of German society because he appealed to a common German patriotism. He also appealed to very widespread anti-Semitic and racist attitudes. They were simply right-wing German nationalists. It wasn't because they were emotionally disturbed losers.
The main political story of the Obama years
was arguably the rise of the Tea Party, which is made out to be this unruly populist movement that harnessed an overwhelming conservative American discontent, right? And yet President Obama won the 2012 election by a landslide.
Well, that's right. But the actual coalitions do not fit into either the progressive or the conservative narrative, which is based on class. That is, the Republicans supposedly representing the working class, liberals, you know, representing the elite. In practice, our politics is based more on region, ethnicity, and race and religion than it is on class. Catholic Americans, for example, tend to be split between liberals and conservatives, and the division is how frequently you attend a church. The more observant Catholics are Republicans. The less observant Catholics are Democrats. Class is actually fairly minor in determining partisan affiliation compared to region, religion, and race.
So is the issue here then, if you are a liberal and you judge these people based on their fundamentalist beliefs of the Bible and all of that, then you're failing to see their potential as a force for liberal economics?
Exactly. The goal of politics is to put together coalitions of people who disagree about everything except for the particular purposes of the coalition. So if you want a coalition for universal paid family leave, why would you turn away someone who believes in the literal story of Noah's Ark? Who cares? You want their vote for family leave. Now, there are some things that are so fundamental to American citizenship, such as non-discrimination racially. I would argue non-discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation and gender, that these are non-negotiable subjects for progressives and rightly should be. But on the other hand, the religious right has lost almost all of the battles in the last 50 years. The Supreme Court, dominated by Republicans, has legalized gay marriage and gay rights, and as well as abortion. That's not going to be turned back. Why turn away religious people? If you look at polls, they actually tend to be somewhat progressive on some social issues, you know, Wall Street reform, pro-family policies like child care. And so you can have enlightened progressive government without giving the U.S. population a Mensa test and flunking half the population.
You say that these narratives that are put forth by the parties and repeated by the media not only fail to hold up factually, but fail politically too, because they leave a considerable swath of the public out in the cold. These are people who are too liberal to be conventionally conservative and too conservative to be liberal.
That's exactly right. Trump and Huckabee, two of the populists, have attacked the Republican Party for wanting to cut Social Security and Medicare, because their white working class voters depend upon it. The number of white Americans who want to combine less immigration with preserved or expanded Social Security and Medicare is enormous. It's nearly 50%. No one in either party represents pro-Social Security anti-immigrant voters. And yet they're a huge part of the population. The conservatives have adopted the anti-immigrant theme. But at the same time, the mainstream conservatives all want to cut Social Security and voucherize Medicare, which their own voters don't want to do. 33% of Democratic voters want to cut immigration. Only 20% want to expand it. And yet that view is not represented in the Democratic Party. When you get large groups in the population whose combinations of particular policies do not fit the combinations on offer by our two parties, you get a substantial part of the electorate turning to outsiders because of a lack of any other choices.
Do you see any sign that these myths are abating?
No, I think they're worsening as a result of two phenomena. One is what has been called the sorting geographically. There tend to be very few conservative Republicans in Manhattan and very few liberal Democrats in Tulsa, Oklahoma. And in terms of message, we live in the world of clickbait. The most inflammatory progressives and the most inflammatory conservatives are going to shout out the more nuanced people on the left and the right. Jonathan Chait in New York Magazine just described Trump followers as knuckle draggers. He compared them to apes. And liberals all cheered him on. None of this is new. But what you need is some kind of political system which is capable of transcending these divisions instead of just pouring more gasoline on the fire. And we don't have that at the moment.
Michael, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Michael Lind is co-founder of the New America Foundation and a contributor to Politico.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Mira Sharma, Alana Casanova-Burgess, Jesse Brenneman, and Dasha Lizitsina. We had more help from Emma Stelter, Isabel Christo, and Michael Loewinger. And our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson.
Katya Rogers is our executive producer. Jim Schachter's WNYC's vice president for news. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.